We have my friend, Andrea Alt-Brutus. She is in the public health space. This will be great for us to continue our conversation about racism as a public health crisis.
An everyday person may be saying, well, I don't know. I don't think racism is affecting my life. Like, for example, what would that look like?
Yeah. And, you know, I could have been that person too growing up, I think, you know, because even though I grew up in New York City, I didn't deal with, thankfully, I didn't have a lot of interactions with racist individuals. Mm-hmm. But racism was still all around me.
Welcome to The Road to Soul Joy Wellness, where a coach and a therapist explore the journey to living your best life on purpose. Here are Joy Williams and Nadine Huesner, your host.
Hey, Joy. New day, new start.
Hey, Nadine, this is great. I'm excited for today because we have my friend, Andrea Alt-Brutus. She is in the public health space. This will be great for us to continue our conversation about racism as a public health crisis. Welcome, Andrea.
Hi, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for sharing with us. To start from the beginning, how do you define public health?
So it's funny because I had taught a class earlier this week about public health and population health. And I used this definition from the CDC Foundation. I thought it was a really good definition. I won't read the whole thing, but basically it just summarized and said that it's protecting and improving the health of the of society, basically. And I do think public health should be that, is protecting the entire population, including the most vulnerable. So that's what I do think public health is, protecting the health of an entire population.
That is so exciting. Andrea, I'm so looking forward to this discussion because there's so much that's going on in society today. And, you know, one of the words we don't often hear is how do we protect the vulnerable? So, I mean, I truly, truly love that definition about protecting the most vulnerable of our society. And we know in the current political, social climate, there's a lot of protection that needs to happen.
I fully agree with you. And I feel like oftentimes we don't protect the vulnerable as much as we should. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think there are some failures in what we do in public health.
The word of the day, 3 John chapter 1, verse 2. Beloved, I pray that all may go well with you and that you may be in good health as it goes well with your soul. That gives me so many questions, but I wanted to get how you got into the public health space.
It's a two-parter. So I first got into healthcare when I was in my mid-20s, which was like 5 days ago. And I was in business for like 5 years after I graduated from college and wanted to do something more meaningful in my life. And so I decided to go into the healthcare space as more someone who looks at the policies and the management of health. And so I spent about a good 15 years looking at research, looking at how can we improve access to care, and how can we improve the quality of care. And so I was doing research for about 15 years, and I became a little bit frustrated with what we call closing the gap between research and actual care. And so I wanted to do something that was even more impactful than just studying the issues. I wanted to be part of the solution. So that's when about roughly 5-6 years ago, I decided to move into the public health space with the idea of doing the work like on the ground in real time, making sure that what we know in science to be effective, to make sure that that's reaching our population. So that's why I entered the actual public health space.
Good to know, because I don't think I had asked you that before.
So,
So very interesting. Now, we know that New York City and other places around the country have declared racism as a public health crisis. So now, what was your connection on race and public health before this has been declared? What did you think?
Yeah, you know, that's a really great question, which is a question actually I had been thinking about over the last couple of weeks for another talk that I gave. And I always knew, especially from my research, that race was definitely a factor as to why people received poor quality of care, had difficulty accessing care. And, you know, in my studies as a graduate student, you know, we think about all these different factors, income, education, race, as these factors related to what I just said, access to care, quality of care. But honestly, over the course of my own work, especially during COVID, I really saw how much racism is underpinning everything. It underpins our income, our ability to, what jobs we get, what jobs we have. It affects our education level. It affects where we live. We often talk about the social determinants of health and public health. And this is where you work, where you live, where you play, where you're born, all impacts the quality of your health, your health outcomes. But honestly, in the United States, underpinning all those social determinants of health is racism. And I think COVID really brought to light for people who really didn't know, I knew, but people who didn't know that racism, we are in a crisis mode. It's not getting any better. Unfortunately, in a lot of regards, it's getting worse. And so racism really is a public health crisis. So I'm really proud of New York City, New York State, other entities declaring that racism is a public health crisis.
So Andrea, you know, when you say that, and I think for anyone who's listening, when you say, well, racism, you know, it's underpinning a lot of our health issues. Give us some examples about what that, you know, a day-to-day, an everyday person may be saying, well, I don't know, I don't think racism is affecting my life. Like, for example, what would that look like?
Yeah, and you know, I could have been that person too growing up, I think, you know, because even though I grew up in New York City, I didn't deal with, thankfully, I didn't have a lot of interactions with racist individuals. Mm-hmm. But racism was still all around me. It dictated whether I could live in a certain community, for example. I mean, I grew up in Queens, but let's just say Long Island, for example. We know from like the Newsday report that came out a couple of years ago that if you wanted to buy a house in Nassau County, you're going to be steered towards certain communities and steered away from other communities. And that mm-hmm. was racism. Certain communities didn't want our kind in that neighborhood because they thought we're going to bring the housing value down. So it dictates, you know, where you live. Now let's go back to New York City. It dictates, you know, where certain the investment in certain communities or the disinvestment in certain communities. When my parents moved into Laurelton, Queens in the 70s, it was a mixed neighborhood. But then white flight happened, and because people fear that the property value again is going to go down. And then there was a disinvestment in our communities where, you know, it was thriving at one point, less and less types of businesses will stop setting up business and shop in those neighborhoods. So you see it there. You see it in terms of where they put bus depots. Mm-hmm. You see it where there's not an investment of healthy grocery stores. And so I remember we had to travel miles. We had to travel sometimes into five towns to go to the Pathmark in five towns just to get really good groceries. So you see it in a lot of different ways, you know, where you could buy a house, where you could shop for your food. Having safe streets, for example. I mean, I grew up during the time of the crack epidemic, and there were oftentimes I will walk to the bus and I'll see empty crack vials. You see it in the gun violence in your neighborhood. So I can go on, but those are just a few examples.
And even in Laurelton, completely familiar with Laurelton, you know, in the 70s, I was really a toddler at that time. But, you know, like even the streets, like, you know, that was an area that had heavy rain and the potholes throughout was just ridiculous. But because of the disinvestment and, you know, it wasn't considered a priority, something as minor as fixing the streets, you know, and you definitely saw as, you know, we moved into the decades, you really saw the deterioration of these communities, which were beautiful communities at one point, and that's why people wanted to move into them.
Yeah, the flooding, you mentioned that's a great point. The flooding in the 70s and the 80s and 90s was just ridiculous. And you know, you had to take it upon yourself to do what you can to protect your own house. But city wasn't really investing in ensuring that there's better sewage system so that the flooding wouldn't occur in that parts of Queens. And unfortunately, last year, I think, is when you saw so many people's homes got flooded and people died from this investment in the sewage system.
Those are so many good points. And I think part of that is some of that when we talk about housing discrimination. So what was sold by Newsday about what's happening on Long Island was just a couple of years ago, which says it's still happening. Yes. So when we look at, because there's a growth in the Latino population on Long Island, and they're moving where the Black population is. So and why they're doing that? Because that's the only place they can live. So when we look at those neighborhoods, and there's still a lack of investment in the neighborhoods, which leads to a lack of investment in education and all these other things, that we're continuing to perpetuate these same problems because of this racism. Yeah.
And you know, a lot of people did not believe, and even I, you know, growing up, really felt like the times were shifting and the redlining was no longer happening. And I remember when I was buying, my husband and I were buying our first home in New Jersey, and I was a child, I was a teen bride in the late 90s, and we had a realtor. This realtor was referred to us by a dear friend of my brother who bought a home from this realtor, and we were looking for Montclair. Remember, Joy, I was like, Montclair or bust, right? And every home she showed us was on a certain side of the railroad tracks. So I was just like, okay. I even said, well, let's just raise the price. Cause I was like, why are we always over here? Are you telling me like there's no houses on the other side of these tracks? And this is where my brother's dear friend had purchased her home. And she's like, oh, well, you know, it's the income, it's what you're looking for. So I was like, well, let's raise it. And I told, you know, and I figured when I said that, I was like, I'm kind of feeling like I'm only being shown homes in one place, in one neighborhood, in one area. And finally, we just kind of gave up on her and ended up buying in Teaneck because it was just crazy in those days. But, you know, redlining still happens. And I don't know if it was intentional or really if it was my budget, but you just never really know.
You never really know. And I think the Newsday article did a really good job with their undercover investigation that, you know, it was systematic though, that, you may not know, but in the background, things are happening so that, you know, there's many people like her who are doing it in such a subtle way so that you can never pinpoint. If it was just you, you wouldn't be able to pinpoint and say, oh, I think something racist is happening here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the investigation really showed that it wasn't just this one person or that one person. It was a pattern. Multiple people. It was a pattern. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think at a certain point, at a certain economic level and a certain education level, Black people don't want to see themselves as being impacted by racism. So it's on an individual level, they would probably ignore some of those things and not want to talk about it. Because even when we talk about COVID and the impact of COVID, the impact of us getting COVID and then surviving COVID in the same hospitals with white people, it was very interesting. And I know you worked on that a lot. So how do you think that the impact of racism showed us through, what do you think it really showed us through with COVID?
Yeah, I mean, it showed us that racism is alive and well. I mean, what's interesting about COVID is that it happened at the same time as George Floyd, right? And so you saw it both on the in health, and our ability, well, us, whether we were going to get COVID, for example, more likely you're going to get COVID if you were a frontline worker, if you were someone who couldn't take time off, if you were someone who took public transportation. So there are many different reasons why you're going to just get COVID, right? You're going to be exposed if more likely you are Black or Latino. And then you're more likely to be sick from COVID, have more severity with COVID because of the history of health inequities in this country, because you were going to be more likely to have high blood pressure. You're more likely to be to be overweight or be obese, unfortunately. You're more likely to have diabetes. And these were all risk factors for having severe cases of COVID. And then you're more likely to not get the access to care because of what you just mentioned before. People getting turned away, or if they did get care, if they did get admitted, more likely to have to get the same quality of care as someone else. We remember that one story, I think it was in Indiana, I believe, that one woman who was saying that, you know, she felt like she wasn't being treated properly because of the color of her skin, and unfortunately passed away from COVID. This is before vaccines and really good treatments, but she felt that her cries for getting, I think it was, I don't remember if she was asking for more oxygen. I can't remember the exact details of that particular case, but she felt that because of the color of her skin, she wasn't getting the same quality of care as other people who were white in that same hospital, and unfortunately died from COVID. And then you saw it on the other end when it came to testing, people being fearful to get testing, to get tested because of a history of racism in this country. People thinking about Tuskegee, for example, when it came to the vaccine, not trusting the government. So you saw all the past come flooding back, and you saw that throughout. Still to this day, with dealing with COVID, you see it till this day with access to antiviral medication, to the other types of therapies that are available for COVID. It's more difficult for people who look like me to and you and I to get certain treatments. So you just see it playing out in every single aspect of COVID, and this is nothing new. You know, we keep saying how it's showing a light on these health inequities, and a lot of times it's even exacerbated the health inequities that we had from, you know, pre-COVID.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting, because I think part of it is people assume that this is only impacting low-income people, when this is not. It impacts us all. Just because you show up and you are a person of color, then you receive this.
Yeah, I think that woman, if I remember correctly, was a physician, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can't get any higher than that, right? But unless you're president of the United States. But yeah, or unless you're like Serena Williams, but even someone like Serena Williams, this is not a COVID example, but with maternal mortality, you know, you have someone like Serena Williams, who, you know, mega star in the entire world. And when she was telling people, you know, after she gave birth to her daughter, that she was experiencing certain types of pains and discomfort, they just dismissed her. And she said, because she knew her body and because she knew how to advocate for herself, she was able to get the care that saved her life. But many Black women and women of color don't have that same ability. Well, they have the ability to advocate for themselves, but unfortunately, people just don't want to hear what they have to say. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's definitely a tragic story, right? I mean, it had a good outcome, but a tragic story that you need to advocate for yourself because of some of the things people believe, which never made sense to me that if one of the stereotypes that people believe is that Black people have a higher tolerance for pain. So, but if you have a higher tolerance for pain and then I'm complaining about pain, you should be the other way. You should be, oh, they're complaining about pain. They have a higher tolerance. That logic never made sense to me.
I was thinking about that same statement you made, Joy, that, you know, well, you know, Black people, because that's why they get dismissed when they speak about pain, because they feel like they have a higher tolerance. But if my tolerance is this and I'm saying I'm a little discomfort, that means I'm probably up to here.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And something needs to be done.
Yeah, and there's other things happening too. I mean, you know, for example, there are cases of people with sickle cell anemia who go and try to get pain medication because they are in severe pain. And, you know, for whatever reason, the providers think, oh, you know, well, supposedly Black people are abusing pain medication, which I think the data shows that we're not the ones who are more likely to abuse pain medication, but you know, we'll leave that to the side. But still, they refuse to give them the pain medication. And unfortunately, I know some people, I know a couple of cases where people would just, you know, go have to be hospitalized after not getting the medication they need or the care that they need to take care of the pain that they're dealing with. So.
And access plays a big role in that, right? If you have access to a good hematologist who is going to advocate for you, that when you go to the hospital or they have, you know, practicing privileges, those doctors will call ahead and say, you need to get see my patient. But we don't have those relationships with our doctors and our providers. And we just become just another patient, another number. And teaching people how to really say, I need this, and having that relationship. We don't really develop those kinds of close relationships with our doctors. We will with our hairdresser, but we don't have the same level of relationships. And I know for me, working as a therapist, I also feel like on some level, even in the Black community, there's a downplay on mental health, right? We do it to ourselves. Like we bought into the lie that, oh, we can handle everything. We don't talk about our problems. So it's almost like we've learned how to self-injure ourselves by not talking about talking about our feelings, and that being strong doesn't mean you don't talk about your problems, or being strong doesn't mean that you don't hurt. But again, having access to a provider who looks like you, I get a lot of calls for people saying, no, I searched you. I want someone who looks like you, code. Exactly. And I'm like, you can say it. You can say what it is. It's totally okay. But I think even in mental health, people will say, well, you know, I feel like I don't have to give you the background story, that when I share an experience of microaggression, mm-hmm. you get it. You know, I don't have to say the person won't, well, do you really think that's what happened? Or, you know, no, this is really what it is. So, you know, the whole access to healthcare in all aspects for us is a main issue. And yes, racism is the underlying, you know, the elephant in the room, per se. We'll speak about elephants.
Yeah, thank you. And you make a great point, inside joke. You make a great point about just, you know, looking for a provider of color. I mean, that's on the other end too. You know, many of us didn't have the privilege of being able to go on to get, you know, medical degrees or degrees in another type of, in healthcare. And so, you know, the search for a provider of color is like looking for a needle in a haystack. It's just, you know, really difficult to do. So it makes things just, that makes things even worse, makes more difficult.
Mm-hmm. It's a challenge.
Yeah.
So now that this has been to the light of everyone, you know, most of it, those of us sitting here knew that racism was playing a problem, but now that it's the light of health departments, and even because I consider New York City's health department to be progressive, and they talked about race and issues before. So how do you think elevating it to that it is, racism is a public health crisis, what do you think will really change in how we address these issues?
Sorry, can you repeat the question, please? I got a little distracted.
Yeah, like how do you think that the response and the action on these issues that are connected to racism will change now that the city and other places around the country?
Well, I think you have to declare it first, which I think is a necessary first step. But I think it cannot end there. And that's my fear with a lot of these declarations. Not just New York City and New York State, but a lot of different companies, healthcare organizations that declared racism as a public health crisis. But you have to now make the investment, meaningful investment, into addressing that. What do I mean by meaningful? And then people talk about diversity, equity, inclusion. But you just can't say racism is a public health crisis. We are going to, you know, start hiring more Black and Brown people and then leave it at that. You have to meaningfully include them into the fold of what you're doing. You have to meaningfully ensure that all aspects of what you're doing in your organization is addressing health equity. You have to really, for example, for New York City, which I hope that they're doing, and I believe I'm going to put it out there that they're going to do this, center on health equity. Again, you know, you can't just, you know, have, for example, in Long Island, for example, Nassau County, you have good health outcomes. But unless you could say there's good health outcomes in Westbury, in Elmont, in Hempstead, in Freeport, do you really have good health outcomes? So you have to make sure you're centering health equity in all aspects of what you're doing. You have to ensure that the population that you're serving is reflected in in not only in hiring at all at the lower levels, but also hiring at the leadership levels as well.
Mm-hmm. That makes a good point in talking about the funding, because I know when we, you know, often we talk about when we look about funding for entrepreneurship and investment, but even on the community-based organization side, when governments give money, they typically underfund the Black community-based organizations. So making sure that some of that happens as well is very important.
I agree. And mm-hmm. I think it's a move towards also trying to include community-based organizations, but you're correct. You can't just, you know, invite everybody to the table and give them $5 for helping out. You know, you have mm-hmm. your community-based organizations have their own operating budgets. They just can't volunteer their staff to help with larger initiatives. You have to, mm-hmm. again, meaningfully include them, which means giving them compensation for their time to be a part of the solution.
Yeah, I've been listening to the audiobook for the second time. It's called Think Like a Monk by Jay Shetty. And one of the things he talks about is that you know where a person's values, you'll know where a community's values exist by the amount of time they invest in it and the amount of money they invest in it.
Yes.
So the whole thing, so when you spoke about that, I'm like, yeah, when we do the analysis of these communities and we really want to understand, because you said meaningful investment, how much money, how much time are you contributing to this, you know, DEI movement that we're all on? I know there's a lot of talk about it, but where's the time and the money
yeah.
that's really saying this is a meaningful investment we're making. We're not just throwing around the words. So, yeah. No, I think that was pretty meaningful to me when you said meaningful investments. Yeah. Yeah.
So one other question I have for you is, so first, those of us who aren't in public health, who might be watching and thinking that we as a community need better outcomes, what recommendations do you have for us to become involved in helping improve the outcomes, the health outcomes in our community?
I mean, really great question. I think advocacy is really important at all levels. I mean, just with your own family, making sure you advocate for yourself and your family when you are seeking your own health care, but also advocating with your policymakers, your local policymakers. If there's bills that are gonna be coming down the pike, then, you know, advocating for that. For example, we know, what's going on with abortion in the United States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that it's, you know, I'm not gonna say all of us who are for health equity are pro-choice. I wouldn't say that. But if you are pro-choice, and you believe that it's the right of a woman to be able to do whatever they want to do with their own body, then write to your local politician and say, you know, I need you to support any movement that's going to help protect the rights of women and what they want to do with their own body. And unfortunately, when it comes to abortion, for example, with Planned Parenthood, they also provide other types of healthcare too. So I think, unfortunately, just that particular issue is going to connect to other issues. It's like a bit of a domino effect. But mm-hmm. I'm going to leave that to the side, because that in itself is a whole nother topic for a whole nother podcast, I think.
Yeah.
But overall, I just
want to piggyback on that I think even in that conversation, it's not just about what I do with my body, right? This is an economic conversation
yes.
too, right? Because someone who is not ready emotionally and financially, you are now almost creating you're sentencing this family, this individual to a life of poverty,
yeah.
right? So
yeah.
it's so much bigger. And I think when we have the conversation, people want to make it about, oh, what a woman does with her body. No, it's really about economics at this point.
Yeah.
Because it affects minorities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And unfortunately, for someone who's so desperate to have an abortion, and they know that they just can't go forward with this pregnancy and they can't afford to fly to a northern state, unfortunately, mm-hmm. we're going to have the types of abortions we had prior to Roe v. Wade, where people were like using hangers mm-hmm. to do back alley abortions. So, mm-hmm. you know, people think that, oh, it's going to be this, you know, different type of society where, you know, people are not going to have babies anymore now, or they're not going to have babies out of wedlock. They're going to, you know, do the right thing. Things are going to get worse in other regards And so, I don't know, I think sometimes people are really Pollyanna when they think about what's gonna, you know, for people who are on the side of stopping abortions, mm-hmm. I don't think they think about how this is gonna play out long-term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. I would agree with that. I think because people are pro-life until the life is born, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
After the life is born, they're not pro-life. And if we wanna decrease abortions and there are other things to do because abortions are actually decreasing. But if we want to decrease abortions, mm-hmm. There are other things for us to do, and we should be doing those things. And there are sometimes there is a medical need. So some of the way that it's going now, and a medical need to save the life of the mother, who we know is alive, like we know it's unquestionable. So it's some things to go to determine that would stop that in those cases. So yes,
or even not even, I know people say, you know, medical needs of saving a mother. What if you find out early in your pregnancy that you're having a child who's not going to make it to, you know, to gestation, full gestation, yeah. Right? Are you going to now, you know, have, you know, walk with this child just because you can't terminate the pregnancy? I mean, it's just, you know, there's just this one way that people are looking at things, and that's really not, that's such a simplistic view of that, oh, people are having sex and using abortions as a contraceptive. I have not met one person who had to make that very difficult choice, mm-hmm. that it was so easy as that.
Yeah, I agree with
you. It was not. So,
totally agree with you.
You know, enjoy, you're right. I live in a state where they're all, you know, it's a whole lot, you know, they're anti-abortion, anti-pro-choice, but, you know, I have a governor who says by the time he ends his term, everybody should be able to get a gun without any background check. So you're right. It's all good. You know, let's bring everybody to life so we can shoot and kill them. Or maybe that's just my simplistic view. As I digress.
So Andrea, you were going to say some more going back to the leaving that aside.
No, just more so just leaving that aside. That's it. I wasn't going to say more about this one. I know that that's a really hot button topic, and you know, it's going to really, it deserves a whole nother podcast. So that's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So this has been a great conversation. Do you have any more questions, Nadine?
No, Andrea, you were really great. I mean, you spoke so clearly about what the problem is, and hopefully our listeners have a better or a more clarity as to why racism is a health issue for all of us, you know, not just for Black and Brown people, but for everybody. It has an impact.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, and I would love to come back again if possible.
We would definitely love to have you.
We will have you back.
Thank you.
It's been great, everybody. We will be back soon.
Thank you.
Join us next time as we continue to focus on living our best life on purpose.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Road to Soul Joy Wellness. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We love your feedback and a chance to answer your questions, and we may even share your ideas on the show. Until the next time, enjoy your time on the road to Soul Joy Wellness.